Okay, so Ephesians 4:16, from Christ the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. So we've got three sections. First one, principles of partnership. What does that look like in the church? Secondly, principles of choosing music. And then thirdly, we're going to look at building a repertoire together. Here's two bad extremes of what can happen in church. First one, the musicians single-handedly choose the music. Why is that a bad thing?
They have their own agendas.
Yeah, absolutely. And like it or not, musicians are tending to think more of the music than other things. Yep. Anyone want to add to that? I think it's true. Sorry, go on, Colin.
I think it shifts the focus of leadership, doesn't it? The pastor's not leading. I think it makes a division then sometimes between the singing, which is then sometimes called the worship, and the rest.
Yeah.
Create a dichotomy between the two, which shouldn't be there.
Yeah, and in the most extreme case, you get the kind of the modern priesthood of the worship leader. With a guitar, who's the one who leads us into God's presence, and then the preacher does. And in the and even with the best will in the world and the best speaking as a musician, with the desire to be as theologically literate, if you like, as I can be, as careful biblically, I'm swayed by the music. I am swayed by the music because I'm a musician. I find music extremely moving, and which can be a good thing, but I need someone sometimes who's more emotionally detached from it to say, actually, yeah, you found a great song that will get people excited, but you know, what's it saying? So I need that. The other extreme, which is also bad, is the pastor single-handedly chooses the music, and then he just gives the musicians a list and expects them to deliver. Why is that a bad thing?
The musicians will often know what might work. Give them a list of 10 things, and they might say, "Well, those four, with the resources we've got, will work, and those six actually won't." You know.
Yeah, exactly. So he's going to be aware of the musical resources, which could be as simple as the drummers on holiday, so you know this song is not going to fly. Other things,
it's being dictated to by a pastor is like it doesn't it makes the musicians feel like they're not really being not worth anything, like they're not being valued very much if they're just being used for something and not being like consulted or involved in the process of choosing something.
So it's not an encouraging model of partnership.
It's a waste of resources as well, isn't it? Because presumably as musicians they know more about music, so at least there should be an input from that. Otherwise you're wasting the resource.
Often they're aware of more songs than you are, aren't they?
Both of them can be bad, because if they bring a single person's prejudices into something, it's all right if something is a universal principle, this song actually is, you know, something wrong about this song, but if it's just I don't like this song, then that both of those will be a problem.
Exactly. And so as we were talking about downstairs in the last session, this principle of submission is so important but partnership as well. Here's four principles of effective partnership. Firstly, communication. This is just life and humanity in a sense, but without communication, there's not going to be much partnership. And again, as we were talking in that last session, sometimes we can find communication difficult between pastors and musicians because we can be temperamentally different. We can have different things closest to our heart, but we need to work on communication, both directions, which can just be a simple thing, but there's got to be communication in the right way. There's got to be submission, and there's a mutual submission, but there's also this submission to the pastor, you know, obey your leaders and submit to their authority. They keep watch over you as men who must give an account. It's in Hebrews. And I think if you, I always want to say to musicians, again, this came out downstairs, that it's essential to submit, and it's liberating, in fact, to submit to the pastor. But you also want to say to pastors that they have to, in a right way, insist that there is submission. And so it's not quite like a human relationship where you could say, okay, well, you know, he feels strongly about, you know. But when it comes down to it, the pastor has the responsibility to the church not to just let people's emotions or personalities hold sway inappropriately. And so, for example, if the music guy refuses to submit his song choices to the pastor, if that's what the pastor asks him to do and says, you know, I'd love to see what you're planning to do. If the musician says, no, I just would find that too restrictive, then the pastor, it would actually be wrong for the pastor to give in, because he's responsible for the church. And so he would have to gently but firmly say, this is what we need to do. So submission is complex, isn't it? It's not just being nice, but there needs to be submission. Review, I think, is very important and easy to overlook when we're busy, because we can spend all the time planning and never actually review what happened. So a lot of, you know, I've done this myself, a lot of time planning services, but very little time reviewing what happened. How did it go? What can we learn? What could we do different next time? Because this is trouble with church, if you can put it this way. 52 weeks a year, we have Sunday services. The train never stops for you to get off and take a walk in the park. And there's always the next week to think about. So review is important. And perhaps most important, an agreed agenda. Because if we don't have a fundamental agreed agenda on what we're trying to do, then we're going to end up with conflict. And one of the most beneficial things that I think musicians and pastors can do, which takes a great investment of time, but to read the Bible together, to meet up and pray together, not just to plan, and if you can, to read a book together. So here's four books. Encountering God Together, which I mentioned. Have a look at this downstairs. Say, we've got this on sale as well. Just about it's 10 chapters on different elements of the Christian meeting. Worship Matters, there's also a copy downstairs to look at. It's aimed more at musicians, but really stimulating in helping musicians think through what we're doing. There's a great Theology of Worship in the beginning of that, Worship by the Book by Don Carson. And this book, short, light-hearted, might not agree with every word, but a very thought-provoking look at why words are so important, called And Now Let's Move Into a Time of Nonsense. To read through something like that together, to find out, if you're a pastor, where your musicians are coming from. If you're a musician, learn from your pastor by thinking through these things together. Really valuable. Or why not come as a group to something like the London Music Ministry Conference in November. Any comments on that so far, or things we want to raise or add? Okay. Here's some examples of ways to have a working partnership. It's going to depend what you're doing. I mean, I'm privileged being in, you know, full-time music ministry in a church with other full-time staff. We're pretty flexible when we can meet. It doesn't mean it's very easy to find the time to do it, in fact, because there's lots of other pressures, but a lot easier than if all your musicians or your lead musicians have got day jobs as well. You're going to be restricted to meeting in the evenings, but so important to meet up, even if you can't do it every week. You can do quite a bit by just emailing stuff to and fro or sending suggestions to and fro. For example, well, my last church in Newcastle, the way we did it was the aim is that about 3 weeks before, we'd get details from the preacher as to what they were going to preach about. We probably already know their theme, Bible passage and so on. We get Bible readings put together, and then I or someone else involved in music would put together a draft for that order of service. We were fairly liturgical, actually, so it tended to be a similar structure. We kind of knew what the structure would be. We put together a draft of music, and then we'd sit down every week in a meeting. We would review the previous week, as I say, theoretically. In practice, that was the thing that got squashed, which was often bad. But then we would look ahead and plan. And really, as a group, we would just start from that draft and kind of rip it to shreds in different ways, or say, yeah, that, you know, that looks good. And we'd also, that's when we'd come up with other things like, oh, had we remembered that there's... you know, there's a baptism, or it'd be good to interview someone about their workplace, or there's some other thing coming up. So we do all of that together. And we had a sit down meeting every week. Where I'm at the moment, that's not possible, at least at the moment, to have that sit down meeting with people who are leading and musicians. But I would, again, we'd know what the preacher's going to talk about, and then I would send a list of suggested music to the person who's leading the service. Sometimes with comments, often it'd be pretty obvious what I was thinking about by the order I'd put them in. There's kind of a shape to where it's going. I might put comments like, these two would work together really well, or we learnt this song 3 weeks ago. It'd be great to do it again before we forget it. Just practical things like that. And then they would then get back to me a couple of weeks at least beforehand with an outline, suggested outline. I might then get back to them and say, and that might include music I hadn't thought of. I might get back to them and say, brilliant idea. I might say, are you totally sure about this song? Or how about putting these the other way around, or whatever. So that's how we do it at the moment. And for any kind of system to work, we've all got to keep to deadlines, which is hard. But once you get behind, it's so much harder to plan constructively, especially when there's stuff going backwards and forwards. And so we can all serve each other by agreeing some deadlines. Maybe be a bit bold in your deadlines. In Newcastle, we gradually moved the planning deadline further and further back, which seemed like a big jump. And was hard for people to agree to, but actually, when we were getting things done 2-3 weeks before, it's just liberating, because it means then you've got a basis from which you can be a bit flexible, but it means you're not just chasing your tail, running around doing things at the last minute. It means if you think it would be great to sing this song, well, you've got time to learn it, even if you haven't done already. So you might want to be brave in seeing if you can bring back. I mean, I don't know what situations you're in. Some of them, it might be you're getting, you know, a phone call on a Friday night saying, can we sing these songs? Or you're doing the same thing the other way around. But gradually bringing things back in terms of deadlines can be really helpful, and then sticking to them. We all know it doesn't take any longer to do things a week sooner. It's just sometimes the pressure makes that impossible. But actually, it can often be quicker, can't it, to do things further ahead.
Quite a bit of educating people in order to get there, I think. And I think if people are actually preaching the sermon, they've got to really have thought about it far enough ahead for you to be able to have those conversations about the music.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe a long way to go on that.
Yeah. And are your preachers, are they working from a programme that's sorted out kind of months in advance, or?
Right.
Yeah. So sometimes you might know what the
passages are. You don't know which one they're going to preach on. I'm still waiting to find out for this Sunday. I've got a choir practice tonight, and I've got to somehow communicate with them about music between getting back this afternoon and choir practice at 7 o'clock. You know,
it can
be a bit tight.
Yeah. And that's hard, isn't it? Mm. And that's sometimes part of developing a shared vision of that. This might seem impossible, but let's just kind of imagine how much better we could be together if we were able, if we were able to do this. Yeah.
It depends a bit on your context as well, I think.
Yeah.
So I was in village parishes and pile a term, and there needs to be a little bit of flexibility as you, you know, as things are finalised.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, in the Worship Matters book, the Bob Coughlin book, there's a brilliant section towards the back of the book on healthy tensions. And he's got maybe 8 or 9 different chapters. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. So there'll be the tension between being rooted and relevant, for example. In other words, you know, earth in history, but also relevant to today, and how that pans out in music. He's got one on the tension between planning and spontaneity. It says we can easily, depending on our culture, think either planning or spontaneity is more spiritual or more spirit-led. But actually, we've got to believe in both. Often careful planning means you're better able to be spontaneous. And it's going to depend on your context. I mean, church in Newcastle, we used to, for most of the services, we'd print out an order of service for everybody with the order on, the words of the hymns and everything. Now, in some ways, that was really helpful and made things a lot easier. But it meant if you did want to change anything, it immediately became an issue because you had to explain why you were departing from the prepared plan and just became a distraction. So we rarely would change anything in terms of change the order of a song. Whereas Crowborough, because we're not giving people an order like that, we've sometimes just swap a song round or ditch a song either for time or because it doesn't seem appropriate, and we're able to do that in a way that probably people wouldn't be aware.
Means as well.
Yeah, and really we need to think of them as part of the team.
Yeah.
And the ideal is, and again for some of us it's a big jump, but for them to be, for example, at the music rehearsals, or even to have one of the musicians who's able to do it, who's not at the front but he's at the back that week doing the songs, because he'll know the songs, he'll know the arrangements. Yeah. And he'll know that if you play a G sus 4 with a B in the bass, that means the song's going to the bridge. You see what I mean? And so he'll put up the bridge. Whereas somebody who's not a musician, not used to all the arrangements, will not realise that, and it'll take them an extra 5 seconds. And so the communication,
you know,
and then, you know, and if providing you want a good you know, you want somebody who can work the thing as well. But and actually, it's not bad for them to be, and it can help. It can help diffuse the tension that you can get between those two sides as well.
Assuming you have enough musicians for that luxury.
Yeah, exactly. Or get them to come to the rehearsals, or come to part of the rehearsal. That might be a big ask for people, but it's in a lot of church contexts today, that's a way we lead the congregation, is by putting up the right slide at the right time, isn't it? It's quite an important role. Yeah. Okay, well, here's how to choose music well. I think it's important to say at the beginning, choosing music, we've got to have a good theology of guidance for this. So here, the points I've put here are what I think are really important principles that we need to hold together. But our theology of guidance needs to say God does guide in all kinds of ways, and God does guide, and God has guided me. Sometimes, you know, you pray, you open the book, and it falls open, and you think, blow me, that's just what we need for the opening song. That's a different thing from saying, Lord, if I open the book now, please make it fall open at the right page for the opening song. That's different. But there's times when trying to plan the music for a service can take me 3 hours, and you feel like it just seems like labor. And you think, why is this? Hopefully, you know, I'm learning something on the way, but you think, why is this? Why can I just not get to the bottom of this in a way that I feel happy with? Other times, it can take about 10 minutes, you know, and you think, yeah, I think this is it. I think this is what we should do. That's the nature of guidance in life, isn't it? It's a complex thing. There is the times when the doorbell rings or the phone rings, someone mentioned a song, you think, that'd be brilliant to sing in communion on Sunday. You know, you've got all this going around your mind. It's a form of guidance, isn't it? That we see that coming from God. Also, for us as musicians, if we go to the pastor, say, what do you think of these songs? He says, I don't think we should sing the last one. That's a form of guidance from God coming through that divine appointed structure. Praise the Lord for that form of guidance. But we need a good theology of guidance. But here's 9 different things which I think we need to hold together in planning music. Firstly, we need to match the themes. And there are 3 different themes that we need to hold together. So the liturgy of the service. So we want some kind of helpful liturgical shape to what we do. Even if we don't call it that, there's some kind of shape to the meeting, which, I mean, you see these classic things in the, say, you know, the Book of Common Prayer and older things as well, don't you, of we come with, you know, praise, adoration, confession, thanksgiving, hearing the Bible read, hearing it explained, types of response, prayer for the world. All these different kind of things are important, and they're not just supposed to be a random jumble. Structure is helpful. So we want to be thinking in our songs, we're thinking of those things. Secondly, there's the liturgy of the church's year. Depending on your church, it's going to vary how much you make of different things. But we're probably all going to make something of Christmas and Easter in different ways. And we may well take the opportunity of things like Ascension and Pentecost to think about the Ascension, the Holy Spirit. We may well, things like Mothering Sunday, that we want to make the most of as well. So however quiet we take those things, they're going to come through as well. And there's times when we might just start a service, for example, with an Ascension hymn or song, something that talks about Jesus as the ascended reigning king, because it's Ascension, even if that's not particularly going to feature in something else. We might do that because there's a certain number of people who would expect that and would be very conscious that it's Ascension and want to celebrate that. And so we're doing it for them. And there's a sense in which we're doing it because, you know, it's not a bad thing periodically to remember that. But so without making a big thing of it, we might want to do that. And then you've got the theme of the preaching, which is very important. And that doesn't just mean we want a load of songs that say exactly what the sermon's going to say. We want to try and help prepare us to hear that particular message and to respond to it. So, for example, if we're going to have a sermon on something which could be quite a difficult subject, like sexual relationships, sexual temptation and sin, we're not just going to sing every song we can find that talks explicitly about those things, nor are we going to sing Purify My Heart and related themes 7 times through the whole service. No, we need to take a bigger thing, don't we, and think what are the particular attributes of God that it's helpful for me to think of before I come to consider, you know, 1 Corinthians 7 or 6 or whatever it is. What particularly? So I'm going to think, well, it is going to be really helpful to think of God's faithfulness in contrast to our tendency to unfaithfulness. So, you know, let's sing about God's faithfulness. Let's celebrate his forgiveness, perhaps before we hear that sermon. And then for response, yeah, there's going to be people in all kinds of particular places. You might sing your, you know, songs of confession and prayer for purity in following Christ, but you're going to want to finish maybe with thankfulness as well, so you're giving a shape to the whole thing, and trying to make that message as helpful as it can be to people. So we've got those 3 different types of theme going on. Comments on that?
I think
Yeah.
It's how we handle it as well.
It takes real wisdom, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you've got the people for, you know, say, well, it's harvest. We ought to start with we plough the fields and scatter, you know, because, well, that's what we do. And it takes real wisdom to know when you say, well, you know, sure, let's sing we plough the fields and scatter, not make a big deal about it. Other times you want to kind of make the point that we don't have to do this, you know, either because it won't help everybody or just because we're not bound by traditions, and it's important to sometimes to remind people that and help them to endure that for the sake of, you know, discipleship and growth, isn't it? And that's just real wisdom.
Can I, on this issue of kind of the structure?
I think, I mean, it can be both helpful, because it can be a way of helping the service to flow, particularly if it's done well, and if it's well, if they're well chosen songs, well thought through. It can just, you know, it's otherwise it can be a bit stand up, sit down, and, you know, so I think it can be helpful, but it can become a kind of god as well, where you feel like, you know, I mean, I've had people say to, and I'm sure you have as well, you know, we didn't really worship because we only had two songs in a row. And what they're looking for is a chance to lose yourself, which takes at least 6 minutes. And so a bit like that quote, you know, from the concert pianist, we're chasing this particular experience of God. And we think that looks like two fast songs followed by two slow ones, whatever. And it can be an easy way to generate an atmosphere, and you can kind of heap some songs together with actually not much thought about the flow of the lyrics. And so you can be, you know, you can be singing to each other, then you can be singing to God, and that so I think sometimes it can be almost a deceptively easy way of making things appear to flow, when actually there isn't really a deep flow to the service, because we've just kind of sung three or four songs. We haven't had a deep flow to it. What do you think?
Yeah, we do it quite a lot. Which is why I think it's quite helpful. Mm.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, to have the sense of flow, if we can call it that, where we're not just having song followed by song, to start before that, when you do have song followed by song, it takes a good, not just to plan it well, but to play it well, it takes musical skill to lead them well, and it's important for some musicians to try and develop that and practice transitions that are going to be helpful and so on. But where we don't just go from song to song, it's really important to have a flow and be clear, and maybe also be flexible about who's leading, and who might say something between the songs, whether that could be while the music, as you say, continues playing, confession thing. So again, partnership in planning that can be really helpful, and it can take more work to have the sense of flow that way, but can be really good.
I think you should perhaps recognize.
Very good point. Okay, so we've got the balance of matching those themes, which is really important. And then I'm looking to, there's eight other things that I'm looking to be just balancing. We're not going to tick all these boxes all the time, but in every service, I'm looking, for example, number two, for a balance of familiarity. So I don't want to sing all seven songs that we've learned in the past 6 months all in one service, because I want a balance of things that are familiar and things that are less familiar. And sometimes that I'm going to think, you know, I might love to sing that, but actually we've already sung two that are pretty new. I don't think we can do all three.
It's not always accurate.
Yes. Yeah. And so keeping some kind of record, which you can do it on a spreadsheet or some kind of database, kind of, however you want to do it. But it's very true, especially stuff that you've sung loads in the past. You might feel you've sung a lot.
And I find as well with
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a great thing to do. Say, look, give us your best. You know, give me. Give
I
me.
Give us your best 12. I actually got about 5.
Everyone's a classic. Yeah.
But it's quite hard nowadays, and it's quite a new phenomenon that is.
Yeah.
There's just such a spread.
Yeah. Yeah, massive. And of course, you haven't got people nearly as much singing hymns in school, and hymns, you know, you haven't got that culture of that you would have had. I mean, I suppose. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, which makes it challenging. Okay, also a balance of old and new. So if I looked at what we were going to sing and it had all been written in the 20th or 21st century, then I'd think, well, you know, that's not necessarily a deal breaker, but I like to have something that's older, because it even if it's just one thing that was written before, because it reminds me that Christianity wasn't invented with my grandmother, you know, in other words, in the living memory of my family, that there have been people for hundreds of years, you know, living for the Lord and working out the salvation.
What about the old hymns with new tunes?
Yeah, which Richard Simkinston tuned for, which is brilliant. Yeah. And they can just bring a new lease of life to old words. If they can, great with people who know the old tune, at least to begin with, because they're, you know, but they can be a brilliant way of bringing a new lease of life. And you can do, you know, you can do old tunes in a more contemporary style, which can also be a can of worms, because you can, you know, you can trash those for people. So you can do "And Can It Be" with a rock beat, and you know, to the "And Can It Be," which of course was not the tune that Charles Wesley ever sung it to, because it wasn't written until, I don't think it was written until after he died. You know, they sang it to something else, which people wouldn't think, you know, people, if you change that, you know, at your peril, but actually it's been changed already, which is interesting. But you put that to a rock beat, some people are going to, you know, just take that as it is. But for other people, I mean, that can cause a bit of offence. And sometimes it can be easier to put it to a completely new tune rather than just to rock up the old one. But sometimes it can work. So, you know, "Great is your faithfulness," you can do to that, you know, "Great is your faithfulness." You can do that with a, you know, with a bit of a lilt and a drum beat. That I don't think that's going to offend people in nearly the same way as sticking a rock beat over "And Can It Be." Yes. Yes. Yeah. And music can be, you know, incredibly precious to people. So I mean, wrongly so often. And it's wrong when that dominates, but it's just pastorally. That's how it is, isn't it?
It's when you get your children who say, "Oh, we sang an old hymn this morning, didn't we, from the 1990s. Mm-hmm. That's old to them.
Yeah.
Whereas to some of the older people, it's modern. You see, it's knowing where the cutoff is. When does it become ancient?
Yeah.
And when is it still modern?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And things people sang when they were converted are often very, very precious. And so I think there's a lot of people with, you know, precious songs from the 80s and 90s. And there's some great songs, you know, at that time. But they're not, yeah, they're almost, it is almost like a generation back now, isn't it? Yeah.
I think the other thing to bear in mind from the chaff.
Yes, exactly. And that's partly why we've got so much good stuff from the past that, you know, it's terrible not to, you know, it's terrible not to draw. Not to draw on that, exactly. Okay, so balance of old and new, also balance of musical feel. Jonathan mentioned if you sing six Town and Getty songs in the trial, I mean, they've written some great songs, done the church such favour. But I wouldn't want more than two, particularly of their things. There's a particular style, isn't there? The "In Christ Alone" kind of style, which can be great, you know, and it's just kind of first line repeated, then a different one, and then back to the first line, and then several verses of that. It's really good because, things like stand up for Jesus, that's written to the same pattern. Really simple to learn, can be really good. But if you do too much of that, you get indigestion. And probably a musician is conscious of why they're getting indigestion. If you're not a musician, you're just thinking, oh, it feels, you know, this is getting a bit dull. So I want a variety of musical style. And when it comes down to it, different keys, sometimes, you know, you just think all the music's in the same key. And if you're not a musician, you probably don't realise why, but it just starts to just feel a bit flat by the end. you know, a little bit dull. You want some variety in there. Number five, approach. So God-centered songs versus people. When it's people-centered, really, still God-centered, but people-directed songs. So by which I mean things that start with me. So purify my heart. Sure, in one sense, is God-centered because it's about, you know, what God wants to do. But it starts with me. So it's like, here am I need my heart purifying. Whereas a song that, which is not wrong, but if all our songs are like that, you would think that Christianity starts with us, whereas it starts with God, doesn't it? And so to sing things which are nothing about me at all, but, you know, immortal, invisible, God only wise, in light inaccessible, hid from our eyes, most blessed, most glorious, the Ancient of Days, almighty, victorious, thy great name we praise. It's all about God, and particularly at the start of a service, that's a great way to start. You know, no fundamental rules, but it's much, much better, isn't it, to start at the beginning thinking, God, you know, let's fix our eyes on the Lord. Then plurality, so I songs versus we songs. Again, both are important. Christianity is an individual thing. There's a personal accountability, but it's a corporate thing, and probably more than we appreciate at the moment in our individualistic culture. We're meant to be corporately the body of Christ and corporately together. And if you look at hymn books down the years, it's interesting how, in fact, I did a totally non-scientific study a few years back and took I think it's the Methodist hymn book from 1933, and then 50 years on, Mission England Praise from the Billy Graham thing, 1983, and then some more contemporary ones. And from 1933, where a lot of the songs are about we rather than I, then it plummeted to 1983, you know, a lot about I. Now, that's partly because, you know, Billy Graham Crusades, the emphasis on the personal response of repentance and faith, which is good and which is important. But I think the church, along with the country, you could say, at that time in the 80s, is in danger of losing its corporate nature. And actually, I think things have improved since then. We're better at thinking together, perhaps. But I want a balance of things in my service. Then I want a balance of depth and accessibility. So some things, at least, that are accessible for visitors, and some things that are going to challenge and speak deeply to the mature believers as well. It's going to be true of the whole service, true of a sermon, isn't it, as well? That speaks for itself. Number eight, I'm going to want to be realistic and think, can my musicians pull it off? It's a point from earlier on, and lead it well. And these are balanced things. So there might be a song that I'm going to think, oh, this would be absolutely brilliant, and I'm prepared to take the risk that, you know, maybe the musician's not going to quite manage it. Whereas if I didn't think that song was going to be so good on the theme after the sermon, then I might think, oh, let's just not do it. And then finally, helping the repertoire. So regardless of all of this, there's the thing we learnt 2-3 weeks ago. If we don't sing it again, we're going to forget it. So we need to do it if we can. There's all the things that I think we need to balance. It's not an easy task. We need God's help in doing that. Any comments? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about what other people like
to do. Yeah, I totally agree. And part of the answer to that is I wish I knew, because there is, I absolutely agree with you, John. There's a right focus on those kind of central things, but there can be a neglect of other stuff. And some of these things on here. So some, for example, There's been a bit of a trend recently, especially in America, to take old hymns and set them to new tunes. And so some of that stuff, just by the nature of the old hymns, it's covering those themes more. And you often find that more in the old stuff. Stuart Townend's done a few as well. I mean, he's done a song, a rich man. It's called Simple Living. And a rich man came to ask of Christ. Quite folky. And he says, in his kind of introduction to it, that Jesus talked so much about money, but we never sing about money. We're in danger of failing to talk about money as well sometimes in the church. And, you know, here's a song about money, and it takes just simple verses, the rich young ruler, and the poor widow, and then you know, and they're really good things.
I mean, one of the reasons why I think it's going on at the moment.
There's a few, and I can't think of who's done it. There's an album of someone setting psalms. I mean, there's not been stuff that's grabbed me.
Ian White.
Do you know?
Ian White, Scottish chap, Ian
one though. No, I think I'd at least half agree, because I think there's so much of a performance culture in our secular music which has come into the church, and so, you know, some of it is aimed at performance, and you get the thing I was saying earlier where the congregation are kind of either disengaged or just kind of half-hearted, and surely that's not how we should be. I think there's a generational thing at work as well, because stuff that's written for you know, but if you're kind of under 25, for example, a lot of syncopation, the kind of thing where you feel this driving rhythm underneath and you float the melody over the top, so it's totally different from an old a classic old hymn thing, because you feel the groove and the melody floats over the top. Now, if you're under 25, you've grown up with music like that the whole time, and it's not difficult, and I find this, you know, I can go in school and teach a syncopated melody, by which I mean a melody that goes kind of off the beat. I can teach that to a load of 8-year-olds and they just sing it back syncopated, whereas I can go to a group of 50-year-olds and teach them a syncopated melody and they can't sing it at all. They're totally stuck, and so there is that musical genre thing, and I think sometimes those of us who are a bit older can think, you know, oh, how are you supposed to sing along to this? And it's just that the style is hard for us. The style is hard for us to get.
I think that's the other thing, is that some of our young people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But you get the stuff with the pitch, you know, the things that are written. So when, for example, Tim Hughes sings, it's boy band kind of pitch. So it's right at the top of that tenor register. No one can sing up there, you know, of your normal people. So you either have to drop them down, which means that then you're groveling in the depths on the low bits. It's very difficult. Yeah. Or you just say it's performance music that we're all to kind of celebrate to. And in terms of, you know, there's nothing wrong with that if that's for me to listen to in my car, or even to have, you know, a kind of praise party thing or background music, but it's not church, and that's the thing. We can't pretend this is church.
Moment, if we've got time.
Yeah.
It's the wrong word, but something played
for
reflection.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, because we do the odd thing where musicians will play something, and I've said this isn't performance, this is something you're leading us in reflection on this. But what's your feelings about place or not for that kind of thing, where the congregation aren't actually singing it?
Yeah, I think it's a form of speaking to one another in psalms, hymns and spiritual songs. It's just that, you know, we're not all singing. So occasionally, you might even do that regularly, occasionally. But if that, I think that's different from saying, let's all stand and sing, and actually the music's really difficult to sing to, and you kind of fail. So I think there can be a place for it. It can be really helpful, but it's not the, you know, it's not the usual thing. No, it's like the, yeah, exactly. And we're just kind of swayed by what's acceptable in our religious subculture, whatever. Yeah. Just a few thoughts on repertoire and building a repertoire, and finish. It's good to think, what are the gaps in your current repertoire, so both musically and theologically. What's lacking in terms of the themes, like John was saying earlier, and then concentrate on. So try and find some good songs on the Holy Spirit or on death and judgment and so on. When you found them, tell me. So if you want to learn something new, and this way, if you're a musician, you're likely to be attracted by the thing with a great beat, a great tune, and think, oh, let's learn that. Actually, what's more helpful to do is think, what are the themes we're not covering. Also, lively songs. I'm always looking for lively songs with good words, because it's so much harder to find a lively song with good words than to find a slower, reflective one.
That's when the new tunes start,
right? Yeah, very true.
A lot of, like, Mars Hill bands that do Greg Kendall.
Yeah, that's great, thank you.
And you can listen to that for those free, can't you? Like the All Creatures of Our God and King.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
you can listen to it free, but you can buy it.
Yeah,
the,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Number two, concentrate on learning a few great songs. So I think it's good to be selective on our songs and concentrate on learning them well. Repeat them regularly until they're learned. And also, musicians play, give them time to learn a new song first, not just so you don't panic them, but so they can actually lead it well, because the better they know it themselves, the more confidently they'll be able to learn it. So if you give it them on kind of Tuesday and say, can we do this on Sunday and teach everyone? Now, you may, you know, it may be that with your people, that works absolutely fine because you've got a couple of people who are really good. They can learn the song and teach it. Maybe that's fine. But if it's going to take people a few rehearsals to internalize a song, be able to teach it, given that song, it's going to be better. Just a suggestion, you could ask musicians, or John, you mentioned, you know, people in the congregation who've come from other places, come with a short list of new songs. You know, say, and I think it's quite good for a pastor to say to the musicians, rather than just having a random process of introducing things, say, let's meet up, you know, bring me 10 songs you think we could usefully learn over the next 6 months, and then you can go through that together, whittle it down, find, and make a shortlist and say, brilliant, well, let's do these. And then, and you can also think about your sermon series on Joshua or whatever it is at the same time, can't you, doing that. Some resources just there. In a list that's by no means comprehensive, but that might lead you to other places as well. Thank you. So 45 minutes for lunch.